Good afternoon and welcome to Lunch with Leaders. I'm Cindy Morgan. I'm the Vice President of Learning and Organizational Development, and I run the Penn Medicine Academy. And I'm so happy that you're here today. So thanks for joining us. Hope you can sit back, turn your email off, maybe you can close your door and kick in for a great hour of good content, great speakers, and hopefully a really engaging chat. I want to be able to help you participate fully. So let's go over to get our a couple of housekeeping tips to get us organized and our conversation started. Let me turn it over to our executive producer of Lunch with Leaders, Youngin Cho from PMA, to give you a few housekeeping tips. Youngin?
Thanks, Cindy. Welcome to Lunch with Leaders, and thank you for joining today. This is a great opportunity for you to hear directly from our senior leaders and to ask questions. So please use the Q&A window to ask your questions and share your comments and experiences in chat. We really do love hearing from you. So, and we'll be monitoring your input and incorporate into the conversation. Hope you enjoy the discussion, and back to you, Cindy.
Youngin, thanks so much for all that you do to ensure the success of this program. I'm grateful. So for those of you who are new, welcome to your first Lunch with Leaders. Welcome back for those familiar names that I see on the participant list. I'm so happy that you're here. So for those who are new, Lunch with Leaders is a safe space where we as leaders can come together and talk about some of the challenges and what it takes to be successful during this challenging time of leading. You can not only learn from our speakers, who are excellent today and every time we have this program, but you can also learn and share with one another, because each of you know things and can share with one another to ensure that you're learning from all of us. So I want to make sure that this is practical and concrete, so I'll invite you to participate in the chat, share some of your own tips as well. And if you are new and you haven't come to some of the Lunch with Leaders, you can feel free to check out our past episodes on the Lead Strong website. Make sure you're telling your friends, share it with your other colleagues and team members, and get the word out there to join us on Thursdays 12 to 1. So let's go back. 2 weeks ago, it was great to see everyone, and we talked about creating a great experience for our employees, and it was Penn Medicine Experience Week. I heard from so many of you around some of the unique things that you and your teams did to honor and celebrate Penn Medicine Experience Week. And I have to shout out Shannon Donahue, who's a senior project manager at Penn Medicine at Home. They were really pumped up about their Penn Medicine Experience Week over there. They actually put on a virtual talent show. And I just had to highlight one of their home health aides, Donna Rivas, who did a rendition of Adele's Hello. Terrence, would you mind playing a couple seconds of this?
Hello, it's me. I was wondering if after all these years you left me to go.
I think you can agree that if the home health aid business doesn't work out for Donna, although we really appreciate her and value her, she might have a good career as a singer as well. We also heard from so many of you saying how much you appreciated hearing from the leaders in terms of the different perspectives, both on chat as well as the guests that we had. And they liked hearing about the similar struggles they had in, or the guests had around the Penn Medicine experience and COVID and how to make sure we're doing all we can to continue providing a great experience. So this is the point in the show. I've got to just do a couple of advertisements. I mean, I think it probably is obvious that there's a lot of stress in terms of the election, and Cobalt really has an ear to the ground around what each of you as leaders, as well as our employees at Penn Medicine needs. And so they're running another session around coping with election stress that will take place this week. So I know that there are many people who are really disheartened by some of what's happened in the past couple of days, and they may need a little extra support. So I want to remind us all that Cobalt is there to help us during these uncertain times. Similarly, I have heard a lot of people call and say, I'm still learning about managing my remote workforce. Can you go over some tools and resources again around this? So I want to point out that we have Leading a Virtual Team Toolkit, and we've integrated all of the various resources that Penn Medicine Academy has put together during this time, so you can continue to watch the Lunch with Leaders session on running a virtual team, as well as many of the tools and resources that we've compiled. So Gretchen has posted it there in the chat. For those of you who are still working in that stance with your teams, please don't hesitate to check that out. All right, enough with the advertisements. Let's talk about today, because I think you're really going to like the session. So when I go around and I keep my ear to the ground and I'm meeting with leaders like you and I ask what competencies you're really good at and what competencies you want to improve, there's one consistent one that comes up. Financial acumen is something that the majority of people and leaders say is in their top three in terms of needs development. And I totally understand that. It is sometimes a little bit scary, a little nerve-wracking, because we don't always have some of this foundational skill, and yet we know it's success, or we know it's important for each of our successes as leaders. I think back to when I came from Penn. I think many of you know I worked at another academic medical center in New York. And so 6 years ago, I think back to my friends from New York calling. They're like, what's the difference now that you work at Penn? How's it different from our place? And I remember my first reflection was this. The people were so darn nice here. And as maybe a New Yorker would do, I was a little skeptical. I'm like, ah, this probably is going to not last. And then you got even nicer. And it still remains as nice as it was 6 years ago. It's amazing. The second thing that I always reflect on that was very different about Penn, it was always metaphorical to me. I thought of this movie, Glengarry Glen Ross. I don't know if you've seen it, but Alec Baldwin plays this hardened salesperson, and his tagline was ABC, always be closing. And so when he would ask me about my Penn experience, I said, oh, it's like Glengarry Glen Ross, except the mantra is ABB, always be budgeting. Because what was clear from the day I started here was that fiscal disciplines was in the fabric of the Penn Medicine culture. And as a result, financial acumen and the competencies and insights that go along with being very fiscally disciplined and responsible was really important for my success back then, 6 years ago as a leader. And as we look to develop tools and resources for PMA, we know that this is really important for our success, not only as an organization, but for each of us as an individual. And now after coexisting with COVID, I think so much of our financial discipline and years of investments and being really thoughtful about our resourcing, I think it really paid off. And so really this topic has never been more important for each of us as leaders to be embracing and getting over our discomfort and leaning in so we can learn more. Our goal, starting today and moving forward into the future, is help you and every other leader at Penn Medicine feel more well-versed in both our structure as well as the financial strategy that is supported by that structure, therefore allowing you to make even more effective decisions. And that's what we're going to start to talk about today. So here are our objectives. One, we want to understand the overall structure of Penn Medicine and its financial strategy to support our mission. Two, we're going to share tips. I want to hear your tips. Our guests have tips. But how do you make sound, disciplined decisions to keep our system's finances healthy, as well as your teams or departments or divisions? And then we have a really big announcement around some new PMA tools and resources that we've been developing to help you become a wizard at financial acumen. I love hearing from you, and our guests will enjoy hearing from you as well. So please feel free to share your thoughts, feedback, questions that you have in the chat, and I'll hopefully integrate some of those in. So let me introduce our guests for today. We have three amazing ones. First, we have Keith Casper. He is our Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer for UPHS. We have Joan Doyle, the CEO of Penn Medicine at Home. And we have Beth Johnson. She has been the former director, executive director of CPUP for 16 years. And she's since moved into a special projects role working directly with Kevin. And I'm lucky enough, and our team's lucky enough, to have Beth working with the Penn Medicine Academy to help us with some of our courses moving into the future. So let me invite Joan, Keith, and Beth to come onto camera. Say hello to everyone. Hi, Beth. Hi, Keith. Hi, Joan. Thanks so much for being here. I'm great. So thanks to the three of you for all that you've been doing and continue to do. And we're really lucky to have this conversation with you. So let me start with Keith. Keith, maybe you can set the foundation for our audience. Would you mind walking us through a couple of foundational points, as well as some of the critical metrics that you're always thinking about when it comes to Penn Medicine and how our finances work?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks, Cindy, for having me on today. I look forward to it. So I think we have some slides that we're going to share.
Yeah, Casey, would you mind putting up the slides? Thanks.
So I'd like to start with, you know, the overall organization, because I think it's key to our financial success. And it really was born out of the financial crisis that Penn experienced in the late 90s. And at that time, before Penn Medicine was actually organized the way it is now, the clinical mission reported into the university separate from the academic and teaching missions, and it really wasn't alignment. And when Arthur Rubenstein came on board in the late 90s, 2000 timeframe, they brought them together under Arthur and now under Dr. Jameson to where we're all aligned across the clinical components of the health system. You can see them there from HUP all the way through to Penn Medicine at Home, as well as the research and teaching for the School of Medicine, whether it's through CPUP or the other parts of the basic sciences. And that alignment requires us to be responsible for performance across all three. So we don't have an over-focus on clinical or over-focus on research, and we really have to look at it as one entity functioning under the University of Pennsylvania umbrella. So if we can go to the next slide. This is an important fact that we have in finance when you look at the three missions. And the research mission and the related capital and the teaching mission and the related capital, they do not make money. And it's not a value judgment on how we value those missions. It's just how the NIH reimburses us, how they have a salary cap, how we get paid for overhead through the indirect cost recovery. We're not able, even though we do a fantastic job in research and our coverages, it does not allow us to produce additional financial resources for reinvestment. The same can be said for teaching. When you look at tuition that we generate, when you subtract out support for tuition and all the costs for teaching, that also isn't financially accretive. So ultimately, we rely on the clinical mission to produce enough financial margin to fund both the research mission and the teaching mission operating deficits and the capital. And it was a difficult thing when I first came to Penn and so long ago, 2004. And it's not a value judgment. It's just the way the government and the other processes are set up. And that research is clinical is enhanced by our research. We see it in the work of Carl June, Jim Wilson, and all the clinical trials that we do. The clinical mission wouldn't be where it is without the research mission. The talent that we can attract through the teaching mission combined with research, it all works together, and the three function much better together than they would ever conceivably apart. And that's the fact that we look like at the alignment, and that how do we continue to have them function together and keep them in balance. We can't ever grow one of the missions to the point where the clinical can't support the research and teaching mission if we have too much of expense or operating deficits there. So we have to invest across all three of them to make sure we're in balance and moving them all forward at the same time.
That's really helpful, Keith. Can I ask a question before we move ahead? Keith, where does philanthropy fall in?
Extraordinarily important. It is, as we look at philanthropy, but remember, we're an $8 billion organization. And philanthropy, when we look at it, it's very important as we look to invest in things. It's around $300 million or so, I believe. I might be a little high on that number. It's extraordinarily important to do things that we can't fund or fund specifically in research, whether it's some of the research we're doing in orphan disease. There's not enough funds to go around. And we'll talk a little bit about it and how we allocate resources. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of great ideas that everybody brings forward. We can't possibly fund them all. And philanthropy is a fantastic way to complement what we can generate ourselves to accelerate funding in a particular area that we may not be able to allocate operating funds to as we move through time.
Thanks.
So this chart is sort of the basics of Penn Medicine. And you see back in the early 2001 time frame through 2020. And let me explain the chart a little bit. The green bars are cash. The blue bars are investments in buildings, equipment, technology, and the like. And the yellow line is our operating margin. And that's the operating margin after we fund the research and teaching deficits as well as their capital needs. And you can see early on in this graph, the operating margin is less than 2%, in some cases nearly zero. The green bar is not growing. And when you don't generate any green, you can't invest in any blue. It's just like your household budget. If you're spending more than you're making, you're taking it out of your balance sheet, which is your green or blue bars, and you can't invest in yourself. And it becomes more of a vicious cycle. You can't invest in yourself. You start falling behind. Technology falls behind. You can't invest in people. It's just a difficult cycle. So in 2004, and I like to highlight the fact that I came in 2004.
I was just going to say, this is all based on you coming to Penn Medicine.
I'm the only one that came in 2004, but we really focused on things that we weren't getting our revenue cycle. We weren't getting paid for the good work we were doing. Our days in the cash, and we'll talk about days in AR and days in cash, were well over 100 at the time, and really focused efforts in getting paid for what we were doing and moving the operating margin. And I have that red line at 2% because that's over time where we need to be above. If we're above that 2% line, the green bars grow. If the green bars grow, we can invest in the blue bars, and then it becomes more of a virtuous cycle. And we can make some decisions, and we'll talk a little bit about how COVID and the impact of COVID, as the green bars grow and the blue bars grow, you can see in 20, the operating margins were significantly impacted. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But we still maintained ourselves. We were able to plow through many of these things and challenges we had because we were in a financially strong position to do that. And that's part of the virtuous cycle, is building that financial strength so we can not only look at what's happening today, but some of the unknowns over the next 3, 5, and beyond in years.
Thanks, Keith. I really appreciate that primer. Question for you. How do we perform financially relative to other systems in our region, nationally? What sets us apart? I mean, the market is changing so much. We see systems going under. What makes us financially unique?
Well, I mean, you mentioned it in your earlier comments, and I referred to it just now. We were in a secure position when the crisis came about. It's not we were disciplined. We manage, and sometimes I know it feels everybody goes through budget processes and it's cumbersome, to say the least, but we're focused on it. And that discipline allowed us to be in a financial position where we could take the impact of the COVID implications and respond and react to them. You can't do that. And I've seen a lot of organizations that do well and have strong balance sheets, but didn't exercise those muscles. And you can't do that. You can't bolt the wings on the plane when it's moving down the runway. That discipline served us extraordinarily well. So I think that was a big differentiator for us when I look at other systems. And coming in strong, if you were stressed and the systems were stressed coming in, you're even more stressed now. And you're having to make decisions that you don't want to make because you were stressed before. There's a lot of systems, the majority of the health systems in America have margins that are zero, negative, or 1 or 2%. Well, you add on the suspension of elective surgeries or elective any kind of elective procedures for a duration of a few months, that negative one turns to negative five very quickly. And then you start going into that negative vicious cycle that I talked about. So it was important that we remain strong. And I think that's a big differentiator. Some excel, some are struggling now with our decisions, and some, while they weren't as strong as we were, are doing well and recovering.
Thanks. We saw a lot of and read a lot about some of our competitors and other systems in the market doing layoffs or mandatory furloughs or cutting salaries. I mean, we know that we came into COVID with a strong financial position, but we also aren't naive enough to think that it didn't have an impact on us. So what do you think we've done right? And what do you anticipate? Will we get more aid money from the government to help us manage through this time of uncertainty? Thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it did impact us pretty significantly. We lost around $650 million when we suspended electives in mid-March, and we just started them again in May, and we spent the last 5 months recovering. We're not quite there yet. That took about $650 million off of our balance sheet. We were able to recover, and the financial grants that we got through HHS, we got about $330 million overall since this begun. It was extremely impactful. So it helped us stay above water, but it also helped us mitigate some of that damage. It didn't cover all the damage, but it helped us move through it. Some of the things that we did well, and I think, again, it's the investments at Epic we made. It's the investments in the people and the processes and some of that discipline, is that we function as an enterprise. I mean, there's a lot of systems that come together that aren't functioning as an enterprise. I mean, when Princeton was first hit with COVID and the larger populations because of their proximity to New York, moving PPE around, sending, I know a lot of our critical care teams went up there to help them because they don't have some of the resources that we had, and being able to understand the resources and move them around the system, whether it's clinical expertise, we did a lot of that with PPE. If Huck or Lancaster had it, Lancaster, it being in the West, was last to see it. Now they have more COVID patients than any of us now. Moving PPE around, what are we learning, and spot buys, and keeping the, whether it's the Patel reprocessing things and that, what are the things that we can do to preserve our PPE and share resources across the system? If I heard it once, I heard it a thousand times, where the security that being a part of Penn Medicine, whether you're at Princeton, Pennsylvania Hospital, Lancaster, not being on your own in that, were huge to us. And just working together, trying to communicate, and it was hard, and there was a lot of confusion, and I think we got better at it as it went.
We definitely learned over time.
I enjoyed listening to Kevin's emails. I found him inspirational. I mean, you get exhausted by this, especially when you're on Zooms every day. And having that communication and those avenues so people can see where we are. I mean, we're not always going to make the right decision. We try to keep the right thoughts in mind and try to do the right thing and just keep on iterating it over time as circumstances change.
Thanks. I know I really appreciated working with you in close partnership. You and your team really were extraordinary and a real important part of our response. So thank you for that. I want to solicit some questions directly from the audience to you, Keith. So if you have a question for Keith, please put it in the chat. In the meantime, I'd be remiss, and I hesitate to ask this because it won't be evergreen since we're in this very strange limbic period between the election and knowing who's going to be the winner. And I'm going to ask you to look into your crystal ball, not about who's going to win, but regardless of who wins, what do you think the change bring about, whoever wins the election? What are the changes that may come to the healthcare system moving forward, as well as our financial health?
Yeah, I need a lot of crystal balls to guess this one. I guess we'll just all wait and see what happens. I think it's whether it's the election or any other crisis, it's continue to focus on what differentiated us from the beginning. And we talked about, we know that healthcare is expensive in America, and we need to find a way to deliver and continue to improve quality healthcare at a reasonable cost across the board. And focusing on that while we're trying to focus on our employees and doing the right thing by them. And I think those focuses, whoever wins this election, we're going to have pressure on Medicare payments and Medicaid payments, right, and Blue Cross and commercial. It doesn't matter. I mean, it may be come in a different form or function, and that's not a new pressure. That's a pressure that we've had since I've been here. And we got to continue to keep on evolving ourselves, but not losing sight of how we got there and why we are. We're delivering the best quality of care and the high patient satisfaction. That's the perfect place to be. Those two things equal financial performance. People want to come here because we're the best at what we do, and we're treated great when they're here, and they want to come back. And we can, it gives us a platform to deal with Blue Cross and that, and all the payers and the employers. You become a place where you have to have Penn Medicine in your portfolio of services if you want to be competitive in Philadelphia and in the region from Lancaster all the way to Princeton. I think not getting distracted by it, the basic fundamentals are healthcare is too expensive. We need to do better. We need to continue to look at how to do it better through technology and quality improvements and deal with what these transitional pressures are going to be, whether it's COVID, change in election in governance, whether it's the ACA change, more Medicare coverage for people at a lower age, whatever form it comes in, we just got to stick to what we know we have to do, which is lower the cost and continue to try to improve the quality.
Thanks. Bobby Goodacre from the chat writes in, how much effect has the transition to telemedicine had on our bottom line? Are the insurers paying for this? Will this continue?
Yeah, well, fortunately, with the pandemic, many of the insurers, Medicare and many of the commercials, paid parity to in-person visits. We were actually just talking about this morning. We went from doing less than 1,000 to over 30,000 a week. I think around 30% of our visits are video or telemedicine. We fully expect that we'll get rate pressure there. You would think it's cheaper to provide that, so why right. don't we, and the payers want to cut, we'll cut what they pay, and I think ultimately that'll be the case. What we have to understand, how much it could cost us to provide, because the building costs are sunk. So leases and
right.
the buildings we built, it was like we're going to unbuild them. But who's providing the visits? Can we do more? Can we provide more access since you don't have some of the friction in providing visits and access that you would have in a physical place? I think the jury's still out. Ultimately, it'll lower the cost. We'll have to find out a way to continue to provide it at a current elevated level from where we were before at a more efficient cost for the payers and the patients. But I think it's more of a positive than a negative, certainly, I think.
Thank you. So there's so much complexity right now and some uncertainty. How do you go about making choices in terms of where to invest? And as you look to budget for the year ahead, what are the things that are on your mind? What's keeping you up at night? How are we going to figure this out?
Nothing keeps me up at night.
I like that. Good.
Yeah. But so really it's a team sport. I, myself and the finance people, we take the charts that I started with. Overall, what do we think we have to spend, whether it's capital or operating costs? And then I work with the other senior leaders and the entity leadership on what are the ideas? What are the capital spends? What do we need to do with operating costs and all those things to stay competitive and the like? And we work trying to narrow down the choices. How well do they fit to our strategic priorities? How well do they fit in each of the missions and keeping them balanced? It's easy to get distracted by, wow, this is a great financial return. We should do this. Well, you can't forget that we have to replenish our air conditioning units, our older right. clinical equipment, our buildings, which, and we're doing a big one right outside my window now, but every building in HUP, I think, is 40 years old or more. And just, yeah, there are a lot of things you can have to continue to invest in that don't produce a financial return, but keep us where we are and spread that across the missions and the entities, because you have to keep everybody moving forward sort of at the same pace. And it's not easy. We get 3-5 times oversubscribed on good ideas. And I really rely on the CEOs and the CFOs to point us in the right direction and help connect the dots across all missions.
Thanks. Can you tell us about our resurgence? How are we doing? Have our revenues rebounded? Are we pre-COVID levels yet?
We're not there quite yet. I mean, close? The last quarter, we're close. I mean, we have a hard compare. We were doing really well when we came in. I mean, the first 8 months of 20, we were doing very well. And, you know, we made it, we were profitable as we came out of the year. We're about 95% of the way there. It's a mixed bag. In September, surgeries were at prior year levels. They've fallen off a little bit in October for inpatient, but outpatient is over. So it's a mixed bag depending upon services. We're close now, and we're back to profitability to a point where we're on stable ground. And as I talked about a little bit before, the yellow line where it's not as high as it was mm-hmm. before, it's in positive territory. So we're not burning off a lot of our resources and our balance sheet, but we have a ways to go. I mean, we are a big organization with a lot of needs, and we don't know what this next wave is. Is it going to slow down? We're at over 111 patients this morning.
I know.
6 to 8 weeks ago, we were at 30. Is it when we started our resurgence, we were at 324. We're not there yet. The profile is a little different. I think we're in a much better position than we were going in before. But where it leads us. And I think we just got to keep focused on building volume and you know, like I said before, taking care of the patients, not just our COVID patients, but all our patients who have needs, and focusing on that and doing what we have to do.
I'm glad you said that. A few people from the chat wrote in, what are our plans if COVID really comes back to where we were at April levels? Do you think we'll shut down some of the procedures and other types of care beyond COVID to keep our beds available? Or do you think, what's in our planning if we can't coexist? Yeah.
Well, I know Phil and the CEOs and many others, probably many who are on video right now, have been planning for this. You know, you plan for the worst case and you hope for the best. Our intention right now is to continue to treat the COVID patients alongside other essential services. But as we find weaknesses in the PPE supply, as we find weaknesses in negative pressure rooms, ICU rooms, I mean, the profile of the patients in ours is different than the profile of the patients prior. I mean, I'm in finance. I'm not a clinician. So, I mean, that's all I can tell you about that. You have to ask PJ.
I won't ask follow-up questions. I won't know them either.
But I think we just got to keep an eye on it. We don't know. I think we have plans or what ifs and how that would impact us. And at some point, yeah, we might have to look at services we're providing now and pull back where – because we just don't have the resources or we can't do it in a safe and effective manner. We don't anticipate that now. And I think we'll do everything we can to continue to provide the services across the spectrum. But again, I don't have a bunch of crystal balls. I wish I did. And I'm hoping everybody's wearing their masks and washing their hands and, you know, doing all the social distancing that they can.
Thank you. So speaking of COVID, let me invite Joan Doyle to join the conversation. Joan, you and the Penn Medicine at Home team were so critical and continue to be so critical to our COVID response and providing great service in the home overall. So I'm so happy that you're here. I know that you know this, but I worked at the Visiting Nurse Service of New York for 6 years in a former life. So I really have such a deep appreciation and admiration for you and the Penn Medicine at Home team. And I just want to say thank you for your great leadership. Joan, what I love about your story is that you started as a nurse manager at Hub a while back in your career. And now you have really built Penn Medicine at Home as an entity that's really helping with all of our services and has been really spotlighted during COVID. It's been amazing. Can you talk about what it was like to start as a nurse manager and work your way up? And how did you learn financial acumen?
Sure. Hi. And thank you, Cindy, for having me. Hello to everyone out there in our virtual world. So, yes, Cindy's right. I started out my career at HUP as a staff nurse and then became a nurse manager on Silverstein 11. And so I learned a lot about inpatient care, both the clinical side and also understanding, you know, some of the financial drivers of the hospital. And so when I went to home care, that knowledge was invaluable. I continued my education and got an MBA, and I think that enabled me to really understand not only financial statements, but also what are the important aspects of making a successful business and understanding, you know, whether it's new programs or growth or, you know, all the things that are important to running, you know, a program such as Penn Medicine at Home.
Thanks, Joan. So what's it feel like to be the CEO of Penn Medicine at Home? How do you know what you should be investing in? How do you go about budgeting, making financial decisions? What are the things and principles you keep in your mind, top of mind, when you're working with your team to think about the future?
Yeah, first and foremost is that we are part of Penn Medicine. And so we participate in not only developing our blueprint for quality and our quality goals, but we really make a point to look at what are the strategic priorities of Penn Medicine, and then how do they cascade down into our program of providing, you know, care in the home and care in the community. And so, you know, from that, I can give you an example. One is, you know, how do we keep patients safely at home, getting care in their home, providing the quality of care that Penn Medicine is known for? So we always, you know, view ourselves as part of a bigger picture, not just our Penn Medicine at home work. And that is, and then that becomes equally important. And we set goals that are specific to the work that we do.
Got it. I think our system as a whole learned a lot about how Penn Medicine at home can be treating really complex cases and patients in the home. What do you, when you're thinking about the future, what strategies are you thinking about? Is it a growth strategy? And, you know, what are the types of investments that you're thinking about for the future, Joan?
Sure. Well, I think COVID really helped us understand how important it was to be able to do scale to virtual care in the home. We had a platform of telehealth and we had been doing some virtual care in the home. We had about 150 patients that were on, you know, telehealth. Well, when COVID emerged and there was a surge in our area, you know, again, part of aligning our strategic priority with the health system, we looked at our strategic priorities and altered them and had to respond pretty quickly to align with what our hospitals were experiencing. So we knew that they were having a surge of COVID patients, and we knew that we had the capability to be able to provide care for a large number of patients at home if we had the monitoring capabilities. So we had not only the ability to measure vital signs, but pulse oximetry, video visits and frequent check-ins with patients. Patients that weren't doing well, we were able to respond just in time with IV fluids or whatever. And this is in addition to, continuing to care for the over 6,000 patients that we already had across our system. One thing that we did learn is, number one, that we were able to pivot pretty quickly and able to go virtual very quickly. And so we plan on, you know, just continuing to grow those virtual capabilities and use, and we've always used telehealth with other patient populations, but if we have a COVID surge, we'll continue to use our virtual capabilities to, you know, support our hospitals and ensure as many patients as possible can be cared for in the home.
Thanks, Joan. Let me go to the audience. I think your word alignment and making sure your entity is aligned with the broader goals of Penn Medicine is just so key. Mm-hmm. Let me go to the audience and ask you to tell us, how do you align your strategies and priorities with the organization or your entity while budgeting? I'd love your top three tips around how you do some of that from the audience. So if you wouldn't mind sharing, that would be great. So Keith, would you mind coming back on? Keith, are you still here? Oh, here he is.
I am still here.
I have a couple of additional questions that I'd love to bounce to you and Joan in terms of, let me see. Sorry, there's one about human resources and investing and the tension between budgeting and investing and trying to be fiscally disciplined while we're in a global pandemic and we're preparing for the future and we're not letting off the gas in terms of some of our new innovation, whether it's in home care or other entities. How do we balance all of this when you're looking at the budget?
That's a lot.
I know. Well, I'm summarizing about 16 questions. I'm doing the best I can over here.
You know, so when you look at the human resources, you look, where are you in the market? Are you maintaining your position? How do the things you do with, say, compensation and benefits interact with each other? We struggle with, you know, what is inflation doing? How is it impacting the staff? I mean, we look at try to understand, we don't want to lose ground in the market. We want to retain the best people. And that's not you don't do that by falling behind in the market, but you have to balance that. And we try to balance that in a way where we can stay above that 2% I talked about and maintain our position and spread some of that risk. And we've talked about, do you give inflation or not give inflation and compensation or benefits, and not putting ourselves in a position where you have to do some things that some other providers in the area are having to do now. And because that kind of thing is 100% reduction in compensation for somebody, as opposed to not seeing a smaller inflation increase, and trying to look at those operating decisions, because it's not once that you do that, that's forevermore. And that basically can put, what the position does that put you in financially versus doing a shared success payment and looking at that and trying to earn forward before you distribute. But it's certainly not easy. There's a lot of difficult decisions and that we have to sort of noodle through. And again, we always don't make the right decision. I think they're well-intentioned and the right investment decisions, and it has to be balanced. And we have to continue to grow the revenue and keep up the market and continue to move the technology forward. And again, we lean on everyone, the CEOs, the clinicians, the researchers, teachers, to make their case, since they know it, if they're the ones presenting it, and then see how it fits across the enterprise in the strategic plan. But it's certainly, there's a lot more gray than there is black and white in the process.
Thank you. I like that you noodle also. I think many of our leaders do. I know I do. Joan, I have to give you a shout out. Manoj Agarwal said that Penn Medicine at Home deserves much more press. The paper suggested Jefferson cared more for COVID patients, but they didn't take into account what we did for our outpatients. Right on, Joan and team.
Thank you. No, our staff at Penn Medicine at Home deserve all the credit. They were just amazing, and I was and continue to be so impressed at the resilience and the commitment of our staff in not only, you know, caring for the multitude of patients with COVID that we've had, but keeping all the other patients that we're caring for at home. And so, I'm exceedingly proud of the work we do, and really, you know, honored to be the leader of such a group of committed staff. So thank you, Cindy.
Oh, Joan, it's our pleasure. I feel like we should get every Penn Medicine at Home employee a t-shirt that says "We are seen," because you guys are just rock stars. I'm so happy you had the spotlight. So I want to say to the audience that we really listen to you. I know I say that and I sound like a broken record, but it's true. And one thing that's clear is you want more financial acumen. And so we're very excited to announce a new curriculum focused on economics at Penn Medicine. And this is a part of our focus on finance, or our focus series for leaders. So we've adapted the focus on finance class with Beth Johnson and sometimes Chad Johnston, hosted for many years with fantastic success and great reviews. And as I mentioned in the opener, Beth, when she left her CPUP leadership role, we are so pumped to have her working with us at PMA. And so I invited her on to tell us a little bit about the new curriculum. So Beth, thanks for joining us here today. We could not have a better, more knowledgeable partner in this topic and many other topics. So thank you. You've been an amazing teacher to me, to us. Tell us, before we discuss the new curriculum, what do you think when you're teaching people about finance and the economics of Penn Medicine, what are the fundamental lessons, maybe top three, that every manager should understand to be good at the finances at Penn Medicine?
Sure. Well, first, Cindy, let me just say it is great to be on here with you. I think Keith must have really appreciated your comment about ABB. Always be budgeting. Warm his heart. So if I were to distill it down to a couple of things, this certainly isn't a comprehensive list, but I think they resonate with the comments that you've heard from Keith and Joan. And first is, revenues just have to grow faster than expenses. And that seems like such a simple adage, but it is amazing how often organizations get that wrong. So intervening early when you start to see trends go awry is really key for that. Digging out of a small hole is much easier than digging out of a big hole. So keep the revenues growing faster than expenses. Second, be attentive to your business. We've talked with, you know, Keith talked about the things he looks at and what does he track, what keeps him up at night. Nothing keeps him up at night, I heard, but unlike some of us that have other anxiety disorders, but the, you know, be attentive, understand what drives your revenues and expenses in your operating unit. You got to understand and manage the whole. There's no silver bullet. There's no one thing you do that will make sure you're managing your finances well. You have to pull on a lot of levers all the time. In order to do that, you need to know your business. And then the last one, I think this applies to life in general. There are no stupid questions. And, you know, you said, Cindy, at the beginning that finances are daunting to a lot of people. And I know that, you know, a lot of us tell ourselves throughout school, throughout our careers, oh, I'm just not good at numbers, you know, and they walk away from it. They live with that fear inhibits it. And it's just wrong. It's a skill like any other. You can study, you can practice, you can learn. And so if you don't understand something, ask someone to walk you through it and explain. I can't, my team got really accustomed to my questions early on, and Jim Rush, my CFO, heard them the most. And I would so often say, take me back to school. I do not get this. I don't understand how this works. Walk me through it again. And I just, that's how we learn. So no stupid questions. That was my last one.
Thanks.
Yeah, I would like to interject.
Yeah,
please, a little bit on what Beth said is to ask those questions. You know, finance can be, no one knows all the answers. I hope to, you know, not get the same thing wrong more than twice. But and I think everybody, but it's complicated and everyone's running their little business. I mean, Joan has home care, but that's a combination of like five different businesses. And inside of that, each director's running their piece of the business. It's a portfolio and it's, everyone has different indicators and you boil them down to the few essentials. There's not 20, there's five, three, and boil it down to what really is a difference maker. And don't get distracted by the stuff. And then, like Beth said, ask questions because not everyone knows all the answers. But I think to Cindy's point earlier, there's a lot of people willing to help and help you with it, whether it's understand it better or help solve a problem that might seem intractable.
Thanks to you both. I think everyone can take a collective sigh that it's okay. You don't have to know it right now. And we're going to get you some tools and some great resources so you can ask. If you're anything like me, I'm really good at conceptual math. Like I always know how much money is in the bottom line, but then I have to work a lot harder to know, you know, strategically what do things cost and what are we going to align resources with. So I've definitely learned from these experts as well as people like Gretchen and Jesse and Christy on my team. So I'm sure all of you have people that you can go to and ask the questions as well. So I'd like to go to the chat and ask, how do you incorporate some of these financial principles that you've heard from Beth and Keith into your planning, to teaching members of your team? And while you're answering that, Beth, would you mind kind of giving a preview on the Focus on the Economics of Penn Medicine course that we're going to come out with?
Sure. So this is a foundational module that is based upon one of the leadership courses that we used to teach in person. So we're translating this into an interactive virtual training program. And really the idea at its simplest is to help people understand Penn Medicine's financial strategy. That is, how do we make money? What are the drivers for that financial performance? What are the things that impact our ability to make that money? And why do we make that money? Where do we need to invest? And Keith has talked very eloquently about the need to invest in multiple missions. We are not in the business of delivering shareholder value like a for-profit company. We're in the business of academic medicine. We have to train the next generation of physician scientists, clinicians, educators, deliver outstanding clinical care, create science. And as Keith said, they don't all have equal opportunity to make money. So we move money around in very disciplined fashion to support these missions. This course helps you understand how we do that, how we're structured to enable that. And that in turn will, we hope, position you to be in a better position to lead and to contribute to those decisions going forward. Now, this will be a foundational module. We're going to be building out other smaller curriculum in a modular fashion that you can then customize a personal development plan that will be based upon your current role and responsibilities, your aspirational roles that you're looking to achieve, and any, you know, self-identified gaps in your own learnings. So we're really looking at this as being a tool set that you can dip into to use over time to develop your financial acumen.
Thanks so much. So Steve said that he, in terms of how he applies some of these principles, he understands the whole and the identify the levers that you can influence directly. So I think that's well said, Steve. Kia, can anyone take this training program? It's going to be an e-learning, so we're going to have it available for all, and it will be required for all new managers as a part of the Focus series. Beth, I'm very excited about this. I think that this will be pretty groundbreaking, and we'll keep building to what the needs are to focus on both business and financial acumen over time. Keith, we're going to look for you to review our first modules and some members of your team as well. So what do you think, Gretchen? I think we're hoping to have that in the late winter, early spring, and have that be distributed. So you'll be hearing more about this, but we couldn't help. We're just very excited about the first part. It's really good. And Beth is our moderator, and she's a really good teacher on this. It will be out in early 2021. So that will be a great course. And yes, Dr. Agarwal, physician leaders and medical directors can definitely take this course as well. So let me ask Keith and Joan to come back on camera, on video. There's Keith. You can come off of mute too. Any final words that you'd like to say about helping our leaders learn financial acumen or think even more strategically about their budgets and their finances as we're kind of going into budget season in a couple of months? Things that you'd give them as tips?
Well, I guess I'll start. I think understand your business and understand how it fits in the context of whether it's your nursing department or your entity as a whole, and be realistic. I mean, these are still very uncertain times. We need to, keep our eye focused on, what are the COVID numbers doing? What do we think we can hope to achieve over the next year, and how that fits? So I think that's it. And lean on your finance departments, whether they're HUP, CPUP, or home care, or corporate, for their impressions. If you have any questions or thoughts, if you think some assumptions are unreasonable, I mean, good healthy debate is always that. I think it helps us evolve the processes as we move forward.
Thanks, really helpful. What about Joan or Beth?
I'd add on to that. I think, you made the comment jokingly, but it's true that, a budget isn't a one-time exercise. It's something we do throughout the year. And that takes engagement with your team. And so being transparent with the data, with the key metrics that you're following, measuring them rigorously and reporting out on that, the good, the bad, and the ugly, will help your team work with you to identify opportunities for part of the solution. Tracking your performance against expectations, that's against your budget, but also against prior years. So, and understanding what's driving that will help you be a better prognosticator for what's going to come in the future. So I think that transparency of data is so critical to how we engage our faculty, our staff, our leadership with the challenges that we are all facing. And I have one last thing is that understanding that leadership is doing the right thing, meaning be intentional about where you spend your time, really focus on the things that are most important that are going to drive performance, and don't get distracted by some of the minutiae. So really be intentional.
Thanks. Really appreciate those practical tips. Joan, let me give you the last word. Tips that you have that you want to share
or things you're thinking about. I agree with everything Keith and Beth said. I think they're important components. I mean, I really resonated with me about the transparency, and I think making sure the entire team, both the clinical and non-clinical, you know, understand their roles in the successful implementation of the budget strategy, and making sure that you are providing feedback about the results, the other analytics that are used to measure performance, and then, you know, keeping an eye on what your, not only what your current performance is, but as you're budgeting, kind of what has been your past performance. As we know, that's past performance is a strong indication of future performance. And so there are a lot of components that go into all of this. But the other thing I like to do, and actually we all experienced it with COVID, is, you know, in the planning phases, it's kind of like a what if scenario. Well, here we put these assumptions in, but what if this happens? And I have to tell you, I've never put in a what if a pandemic hits us in our 2020 budget. I never dreamed we would have to do that. But I do think it's important to, you know, have a little bit of thought about what could go wrong or what could really go right that might accelerate what you're doing. And then I think, you know, you won't be caught off guard with, you know, surprises that come your way, but you'll be able to say, oh yeah, we've thought about this and here's what we're going to do to adjust what we're seeing in our financial performance or our budget going forward. So thank you, Cindy.
Thanks, Joan. So let me express my deepest gratitude to Keith, Joan, and Beth for joining me on the show today. I thought it was a great conversation, and it just whets the appetite of giving our leaders and our Penn Medicine population even more financial acumen. I hope you'll tune in 2 weeks. It will be right around Thanksgiving. Where did this year go? But we're going to celebrate with an attitude of gratitude, and we're going to focus on what you can do to recognize and reward your team. It's easy to be very grateful at Thanksgiving, and we'll give you tips for ensuring that that attitude and your strategies for recognition can continue throughout the year. We'll have Dr. Dan Feinberg for PAH. We'll have Laura Porter. We'll have Mike Restuccia, and Susan Sturkenberg will be here from LG to be my PMA subject matter expert. So I hope that you'll join us. And please make sure you mark your calendar. We have an amazing lineup for the rest of the year into 2021. We have onboarding new Penn Medicine leaders. We have a year in review to close out the first year of Lunch with Leaders. And I want to acknowledge so many of you who come back week after week, show after show, and hear about some of your favorite moments. I start off the year with a dream interview of Kevin Mahoney. Then we'll check in with Eve Higginbotham and Dwayne Duckett around steps for eliminating racism, bias, and inequities and where we are in that work. As well as in February, we'll talk to the team that is updating the Penn Medicine Blueprint. So please, we love hearing from you. Send me your feedback. We have a survey, and we always are listening for what topics you'd like to cover. I want to thank you so much for all that you're doing to help us coexist with COVID, for helping to lead our resurgence, and for doing all you can to make your teams feel as engaged as possible. We value you. We see you. We want to thank you, and I'll look forward to having you join us on our next lunch.